Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the History of Music and Technology. I'm Sarah Wallenhoff, your guide on this long journey. There is so much we can learn from looking at our past, covering 40,000 years of human history, and how we've interacted with music, how that interaction has changed over the eons based on the technology evolving. There are so many interesting topics we'll cover. So we'll cover technology, we'll cover, of course, history, we're going to cover philosophy and culture, and a little bit of music theory. The whole point of this broad historical survey is to look for connections, how we got to where we are today, why we tend to have the values as a society toward music that we do today. Everything we now take for granted has been built upon the foundations of past innovations and ideas, many that are centuries old, and I love to explore those. Please note that these episodes have been taken from my actual lectures I give when I teach this general education class to upper division undergraduates. So you might hear me reference downloadable slides or videos or links that I recommend. These can all be accessed at the links given in the description of each episode. So if you want to check out these videos or links yourself, you can do that. Now, without further ado, let's continue the exploration of history, technology, and music. In the efforts of going electric, you have to remember that after World War I, record companies were facing competition with radio. Radio had better sound quality because they were simply projecting what was going through the microphones onto the radio waves and being transmitted directly to the listeners. Not to mention that radio was free. RCA Victor realized they needed to update their system of recording in order to even compete with radio. So by early 1925, RCA Victor was motivated to license the Westrex system. Victor's earliest electrical recording session with the Westrex system occurred in February of 1925 in Camden. This was of a vocal group which performed what was called miniature concert. And you're able to listen to that recording in this video. What I'm sure you've noticed by now is some of the advantages to electric recording, those being an expanded frequency range, matching that of a much more natural spectrum of the human ear. And this is all thanks to the condenser mic. Instruments like double basses could now be heard in ensemble textures without augmentation. Sometimes arrangers would copy the bass part into another instrument of that range that could be heard better, like a tuba or a bass clarinet. Now that was unnecessary. Another really nice benefit of electric recording was the capturing of the ambiance of the room in which the session was taking place. That ambiance and atmosphere could be heard in the recording and made for a much richer listening experience. And percussion. There was always a danger with acoustic recording that a lot of percussion would cause the horn to shake or the needles to skip. But with the Westrex electric system, percussionists could play freely without that fear. So all in all, it made for a huge leap forward in the quality of recording. As a means of review, the 78 became standard by 1925 thanks to the electrically powered player. Remember, up until that point, the playback turntables were first hand cranked and then employed spring motors to help even out that speed. By the time electrically powered players came about, the stability of the rotations was ensured. Now, an interesting thing about the disc is that we had the electrical recording process improved by 1925. We had the playback systems improved by 1925. But the 78s remained all the way until 1948. Now, RCA Victor tried in 1931 to create a longer playing record, but it didn't work out. And we'll discuss why in the next unit. So because of that, the 78 wouldn't get updated for another almost 18 years. So imagine that. You had updated players, updated recording process, but the medium on which that sound is stored is still the old 78. But in 1948, Columbia released the LP on vinyl. And then RCA, like we mentioned, released the 45 within the next 6 months. At the time the LP was introduced, nearly all phonograph records, the 78s, were abrasive and noisy, had a limited playing time to less than 5 minutes. But the Columbia LP was a 12 or 10 inch fine grooved disc made of vinyl, and it played with a smaller tipped microgroove stylus at 33 and a third RPM, so that each side of a 12-inch LP could play for more than 20 minutes. Can anyone guess what styles of music really benefited from a disc that could hold total of 40 minutes on two sides? If you said classical and Broadway, you're absolutely right. Now, in the earliest days of recording, some composers used recording to simply preserve and study music folk traditions that were in danger of being stamped out by modern advances. Some famous composers who used this technique were Kodály and Bartók. And by recording these folk traditions, they were able to incorporate these styles into their own music and help spread them. After World War II, among the first to purchase tape recorders were musicians that wanted to emulate and understand the free-form improvisatory music that was newly emerging in jazz, R&B, and rockabilly. Improvisation is not written down, improvisation is not repeated. So what better way to try and understand this new form of music than by recording it as it happens live to go back and learn from it? So these field recordings were meant to capture a form of music that was previously unrepeatable, to be studied and better understood by the next generation of music creators. But now, with the ability to manipulate tape recordings so easily and without degradation, the roles of artist, composer, and technician began to blur. In Germany, during World War II, German engineers had perfected the magnetic tape recorder, basically a reel-to-reel, or they called it a magnetophone. It was the German company AEG who had created the first practical magnetophone in 1935. And by the outbreak of World War II in 1939, German radio engineer Walter Weber radically improved tape sound quality by introducing a thing called AC bias. AC bias eliminated distortion and background noise, which, of course, not only set it apart from previous attempts with magnetic tape recording, but of course set it apart from current recording on wax records. On this slide, you can see a cool photograph from some magnetophones from the mid to late 40s. During the 40s, of course, wealthy individuals had their own magnetophone systems, and Hitler even ordered a machine for himself to the Russian front when he was first introduced to it in 1942. Now, the Allies during World War II were first made aware of the possibility of this technology when they were listening in to German radio broadcasts, and they heard, for example, the sound of orchestras playing. But the problem was these broadcasts were happening at weird hours, like 2 a.m., and they sounded so pristine and so clear. The Allies thought for sure these had to be live performances, live broadcasts. And so there was a rumor that went around that Hitler was so evil he made his German orchestras perform for him at crazy hours like 2 a.m. So naturally, while serving in the war, many Allies, including American soldiers, were encouraged to find out more about these German radio broadcast technologies that astounded them. One of these was Jack Mullen, who you can see on the left side of this photograph here. Jack Mullen was assigned, of course, to find out everything he could about electrical engineering while in Germany. He was visiting a radio studio near Frankfurt and came across two high-fidelity magnetophones and 50 reels of tape. He ended up shipping these home so that he could work on them, so he could explore and experiment and see what this technology was all about. And over the next 2 years, he made improvements to that technology. He hoped to impress people in Hollywood with this technology. You may remember we've seen examples in the past of big corporations, for example, not willing to take a risk on new technology just yet. In Hollywood, we'll see more examples of Hollywood not willing to take more risks. But this is another one of those examples where Mullen tried to convince a lot of these radio engineers and broadcasters the impressiveness of this technology and the things you could do with it. The only one who got excited about it was the radio producer for Bing Crosby. He was very impressed, and he knew Bing Crosby was super duper interested in a technology that would allow him to pre-record his radio broadcasts so he wasn't limited to only doing his shows live. And so by 1947, Bing Crosby attended a private demonstration of Mullen's improved magnetophone machine,
and he was stunned by the sound quality and instantly saw the potential of magnetic tape recording.
By the time the recording industry began to recover after the war, all this technology was now available to not only produce long playing discs with a much better frequency response, but carry recordings that had been edited with tape to give the cleanest possible performance without degradation. Let's talk about the tape revolution brought about because of Bing Crosby's influence. You have to remember that up until 1947, radio broadcast shows were aired and made live. Because again, live shows had a superior sound quality to pre-recorded shows on disc. In fact, several major networks prohibited the use of pre-recorded discs because of the comparatively poor quality. But Bing Crosby found live broadcast too demanding and restrictive. He was looking for a way to spend more time with his family and ease his workload. He, on occasion, had to broadcast a show twice, once for the East Coast and once for the West. And he disliked the restrictive nature of the broadcast. His style was freeform, which that was hampered with strict time constraints. And the lack of editing capabilities meant that his jokes had to be told precisely according to script with no room for error or ad-libs. And so he was looking into ways to pre-record his shows on disc. And it was at this point that Bing Crosby met Jack Mullen. Mullen was asked to do a test recording of the first show to be aired for the 1947-1948 season of Bing's Philco Radio Time on ABC. And it was a success. History was made as the very first radio show anywhere in the world to be recorded directly on magnetic tape was broadcast on October 1st in 1947. Now, the taped shows were still transferred to disc for broadcast because of fear of tape breakage. You have to remember that the only tape in existence at this point were the materials that Mullen brought back from Germany. There was no spare tape to be used if a tape reel broke. But the next several shows were then constructed on the magnetophone, where editing could be accomplished with literally scissors and tape, with no loss of quality. And then in April of 1948, Ampex worked closely with Jack Mullen to develop its first prototype tape recorder with new tape reels from 3M to begin transcribing the rest of Bing's 1947-1948 season. And unfortunately, Ampex lacked the funds to go forward with commercial production. And upon hearing this, Bing Crosby sent them a check for $50,000. That's around $500,000 today. It was nothing fancy, just the money in an envelope. I love it that that's how badly Bing Crosby wanted this new technology for his own use. So some of the advantages of recording to tape. Mistakes could be repaired, so Bing and his audience were much more relaxed during recording. Time constraints were eliminated since the show could be cut to the proper length while preserving the best moments. And Bing Crosby could go off script if he wanted to. The audience was allowed to laugh and react naturally. In fact, during one taping, the audience laughed so long in response to Bing and his guest that Mullen later cut it to proper length and was ready to discard the extra tape. Happening by at the right time, Bing told Mullen to save it for future use. And this is the birth of the laugh track. Bing Crosby and Jack Mullen ended up saving libraries of audience reactions to be reused. Everything from outbursts of laughter to groans and all these other reactions. Until now, editing was limited to physically cutting and splicing together sections of tape. But in 1949, the Ampex 300 arrived, and that made overdubbing commercially feasible. And this capability utterly transformed Bing Crosby's radio show and helped pave the way for studio music editing. In other words, one show could now be constructed from many different recording sessions. If Bing wanted to record a show segment in Nevada or in San Francisco or in Canada, the acoustic properties had to match those of the previous recordings in Hollywood or New York. To accomplish this, Jack Mullen constructed a filter box that could alter the characteristics of a location and add echo if need be. So no matter where Bing Crosby wanted to record, Jack Mullen could manipulate the recording to make it match any other previous recordings, to make it sound like it was all done in one show. In fact, the last 5 seasons of the Bing Crosby Show on CBS never actually happened the way they sounded when they were broadcast. They had each been constructed from a carefully managed catalog of pre-recorded material that was organized by date, artist, songs, and subject, and this saved on new session time. This was the first step in moving music recording from simply preserving and reproducing live events as they happened to becoming an art form all its own. If technology can now provide a way for music to become a lasting studio art, then that means the studio itself and the engineers in that studio have roles that are transformed to reflect that change. This video is a wonderful brief look from a documentary and interview with Tom Dowd, who was an extremely influential recording engineer. You can see examples from the earliest recording studio technology into the more modern styles up into the 60s and see how the technology assisted the changing role of the engineer. One fantastic example of this is Phil Spector's Wall of Sound. You'll probably recognize its quality. It has sort of that very intense echo and layered sound. And there's a very specific reason why Phil Spector did this. During the 60s, recall that the technology available for pop music delivery was on AM radio stations and on the 45s in jukeboxes. So Phil Spector preferred the control he had over building his wall of sound into a sonic experience appropriate for AM radio. He exploited what the studio could offer to create this really dense orchestral aesthetic that would sound rich and full on the listening mediums that were currently available. And how he did this was basically taking the idea of the string choir first emerging in France in the 17th century. His arrangements called for large ensembles and included several instruments that weren't generally used for pop music, such as electric and acoustic guitars. Sometimes he would bring in a harpsichord. Multiple instruments would double or triple many of the parts to create a fuller, richer tone. Again, it's the same physical technique as using a choir of violins to enrich the sound. And on top of this instrumentation, Phil Spector would highlight reverb from specially made echo chambers that he created in his studio to add texture to the overall sound. And then this echo-laden sound was channeled back to the control room and recorded on tape. The intricacies of this technique were unprecedented in the field of sound production for popular music, and this resulted in a rich, complex sound that was rarely heard in musical recordings of the day. Now, where would modern recording be without multitracking? Imagine this. If you were part of a rock band and you wanted to lay down a recording of one of your songs, if all you had was one strip of tape on which to record your sound, you had to have every member of the band there in the studio room, ready to record in the same manner you would play the piece live. And several different microphones would pick up each of the parts as they played all together. So it worked, and you could make edits, of course, but you were limited to who you could have in the room at the same time as to what parts you would hear. And it also meant that the recording engineer would have to manipulate the gear at the same time to make sure everything was balanced as it got recorded on tape. Multitracking released all of those demands and made for freer, more creative possibilities in recording. We largely can thank Les Paul for this innovation. Les Paul built a recording studio and workshop in the garage of his Hollywood home in 1945. He was a friend of Bing Crosby's, and Bing had given him an early Ampex tape recorder, which, remember, Bing Crosby helped fund. And Paul added a second recording head to the device to enable the recording of 2 individual tracks that could be played back simultaneously as if they had been recorded all at once in one take. This was the beginning of multitracking. That is, separate elements could be recorded at different times. Paul's technique enabled him to listen to the tracks he had already taped and record new parts in time alongside them. If you're interested, you can hear one of my more recent pandemic pieces. I was enjoying some time in my basement studio and decided to record, to play around with not only my violin, but also my native trail flute and a little pentatonic hand pan. So this is a great example of being able to layer an entire rich piece of music with one person. This is all just me playing, and I wouldn't be able to do that during the lockdown of 2020 without multi-tracking. So it's a tremendously useful and advantageous technology. Some of the other advantages to multi-tracking include that it ensures that there's a proper balance between each layer. In the earliest days, when you only had one microphone that the entire band had to stand around, you would have to place different instruments different distances from that microphone to create balance. But with multi-tracking, you can just track each layer separately, and there's no competition of volume between two or more parts at once. There's much easier control and manipulation over each separate layer that won't affect the other layers. In fact, you can save them and go back to them later if you decide to raise the levels of one part over another. There's the reducing the need for multiple musicians, since, as we saw with Les Paul and my little example, several parts could now be layered on top of each other by one musician recording one track at a time. That also means, in the economic side of things, that does create problems for the job security of musicians, but it does open the door for artists of all backgrounds to be able to record their own works without having to rely on or pay for additional people. So this multi-track technique is the primary method of recording most music today. And it's not only drastically changed the sound of popular music, but as we said, has opened many more possibilities for individual artists and for non-mainstream music.
So let's take a moment and just summarize this whole idea of what big changes happened to the studio because of these advancements, the advancements that we saw as an example in the life of Tommy Dowd, the advancements that Phil Spector used to create his definitive wall of sound, Les Paul's ingenious idea of multi-tracking, Ampex's development of the reel-to-reel tape to include overdubbing. All of these contributed to transforming the role of the engineer and the role of the music studio. So number one, the role of the engineer moved from technician, someone to just make sure that the microphones didn't peak, for example, to creative partner. We'll see an example of that with Ken Heyman with the Cleveland recording studio. But basically, making records was an extension of the radio engineer at first, someone that was able to maintain simply the operation of the equipment. But one of the changes to how the engineer interacted with the equipment included the invention of faders instead of the old radio broadcast knobs. And this allowed the engineer to make artistic adjustments easily during the session. In the words of Tommy Dowd, playing the faders like a piano. Number two, before multi-tracking, you would use one microphone in one room, and even then you could add more mics. But without multi-tracking available in the 1950s, the balance between layers still had to be done in the room during the recording, all at the same time. Nothing could be adjusted without doing another take. So engineers had to mix while recording, which again, having faders installed instead of knobs was a big help for them. Now, number three, multi-tracking is introduced by Les Paul in the late 40s, and then adjustments can be made long after the recording was first laid down. When tape starts being used in the studio starting around 1948, it allowed for editing and advanced artistic techniques. We're going to see examples of that with, for example, the Sgt. Pepper album by the Beatles. And then finally, number five, by the 60s, artists would use the studio as a place to experiment and create rather than a place to record a well-rehearsed performance. So as a great example of that, do you know how many hours it took the Beatles to record Strawberry Fields Forever? It took them 55 hours of studio time to record that one song. Now, that's not because they were terrible musicians or ill-prepared or anything like that. It's because they used that studio time to explore and experiment, rather than, as their predecessors had done before, using the studio to just simply lay down a record of a already rehearsed live performance.
Before the mid-20th century, smaller independent studios had to be extremely creative and experimental to survive. They didn't have the funding that the major studios had. But this quality is what attracted many non-mainstream popular artists to these small studios. So while there might not be as much funding, that means there's more creative freedom for the artists. Engineers like Ken Heyman devoted considerable energy to finding ways of accommodating the increasingly experimental recording ambitions of his music clients. Ken Heyman was an engineer at the Cleveland Recording Company. He described his experiences there as an evolutionary process, adapting old broadcast technology to the needs of an evolving music production studio, and vice versa. For example, in the mid-50s, he developed faders to control individual channels while recording, by which, in one hand, with just four fingers, an engineer could balance levels while the recording was taking place. But that meant that the engineer, in a sense, was one of the musicians. He was making decisions with and for the band as it recorded. There were, of course, a couple of seminal albums that had come out during this time that influenced artists. One of those was, of course, the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper, which featured brand new studio techniques like pitch shifting, which was recording tracks at different speeds to raise or lower the pitch. They used a technique to apply delay effects using tape loops and echo chambers. And there were other experimental aspects about the whole album, like the influence of non-Western sources like classical Indian music. Everything about the release spoke to the idea of an album of songs being an entire piece of artwork, sort of reminiscent of those classical symphonies or the mass cycles in the medieval period. And this kind of idea was only made possible with popular music's adoption of the longer playing times offered by the LP. Beatles engineer Jeff Emerick said that we had gotten used to being asked to do the impossible, and we knew that the word no didn't exist in the Beatles vocabulary. Another recording that was similarly influential during the time was Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys. So with these two recordings on the market and out in people's ears, it was the job of the engineer and producer to interpret other bands' artistic ideas that were inspired by those albums and to transform them into practical effects for recording. One early example from Ken Heyman was during the 70s, he said, there was a session during which a rock group chopped up a piano in the basement while Ken mic'd the process. In other sessions with Joe Walsh, who went on to greater renown as a member of the Eagles, Heyman recalls that we tried out different ways to modulate his voice. We ran his voice and or guitar through a Leslie speaker and tried all kinds of unusual things. Heyman said that we were told more than once that our freedom, the freedom that the producers and musicians enjoyed in our studio, was far beyond what they could have in either New York, Nashville, and Los Angeles, in particular because the unions out there would prevent anybody from getting your hands on the controls. And that's an interesting point, because unions are there typically to help ensure jobs. But with this kind of experimentation that we see in the studio of the 60s and the 70s, the job descriptions started to be blurred. The engineer was now one of the musicians and artists. The musicians could very well be also technical engineers and have ideas in how to create these effects they were experimenting with. Without the delineation of job definitions, there was freedom to explore what the studio could produce for music. And Paul McCartney explained that his goal was to create a record with songs that could not be performed live. He had declared, "Now our performance is that record." And that is a really important statement for the shift in thinking about music that was brought about because of recording. We've been saying this the entire course, but prior to the 20th century, music was fleeting. Music was based in time passing. Music was live. You could either watch somebody perform it or do it yourself. And the only way to preserve it was to notate it. So sheet music became a way to share and communicate ideas. But once recording technology got to this point of the 60s and 70s, now artists could reconsider the role of music from a fleeting experience that had to be done live to an actual kind of artwork that was created in the studio and could not be performed live. So the independent studio became a refuge for this new symbiotic relationship of mixers and musicians, where technology would be constantly adapted and pushed to its limits in exploring new aesthetics that were only made possible by that technology. By the early 1970s, there were four factors that transformed the work of sound mixers from a technical craft to a modern art form. And these four components were the ingenuity and knowledge of the engineer, the willingness of the studio owner to take chances and trust their engineer's activities, the willingness of all parties, engineer, producer, and musician, to collaborate and share ideas, as well as share the roles in music making, and independence from large companies or organizations, which allowed for exploration and learning by trial and error. So it was a really dynamic, exploratory time for music in the studio.